You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. Walk it out and
move on day. Over 2 million homes across California depend on the essential care provided by more than 300,000 domestic workers in the state. Yet they remain without health and safety protections in the workplace. Care workers, who ensure our economies have a healthy workforce, are ironically and sadly marginalized and invisibilized by intentional exclusion from worker protection laws. These exclusions are a remnant of the United States' legacy of slavery and discrimination against black and brown immigrant women workers that continue on in California State's Labor Code today. To address this historic inequality, last year, the California Domestic Workers Coalition, or the CDWC, worked with the National Domestic Workers Alliance to create SB 686, organized a historic rally of over 600 domestic workers in Sacramento in August this year to push Governor Newsom to sign SB 686 into a bill. I got to sit down with Kimberly Alvarenga, the executive director of the California Domestic Workers Coalition, to discuss why SB 686 is important and how domestic worker organizing is one of the most important and feminist movements in the country. So hi, Kimberly. Welcome to our show. We'd love to begin by having you share a little bit about the work that you're doing with the California Domestic Workers Coalition. What is the CDWC? How did it come about? And what is the work that y'all are doing?
Sure. First, I just wanted to say thank you, Preeti, for having me on the show. Really appreciate it. Well, the California Domestic Workers Coalition was founded in about 2006. And we're a statewide coalition of organizations that have programs within them that support domestic workers. Some of those centers are also worker centers, day labor centers. As the coalition is also made up of employers and other labor allies. And we work to advance the rights and the dignity of domestic workers that are primarily immigrant women of color that do this important work. And one of the reasons that we organize is that domestic workers have been historically excluded from many labor protections. And these exclusions really are rooted in a history of racism in this country. Back in the 1930s, when there were a lot of industries or workers obtaining legal protections or worker rights, it was Southern lawmakers that refused to support any policies that included two industries at the time, domestic workers and farm workers. And at that time, it was Black women that were doing domestic work. And so these Southern lawmakers refused to support these policies. And ever since then, domestic workers have been advocating to become equal, to be equal under the law when it comes to labor protections. And so we're a member-based coalition, and our membership really decides the priorities of our work and the direction of our work. And that's what we do.
Great. And more recently, 2 weeks ago, you had this amazing rally in Sacramento around pushing for a bill called SB 686. What is this bill? What are its demands? And how will it help? How will it support domestic workers?
Yeah, SB 686, the Health and Safety for All Workers Act, authored by Senator Maria Elena Durazo and principal co-authored by Assemblymember Wendy Carrillo. What the bill does, I just shared that there is just a legacy of exclusion from many labor protections for domestic workers. And unfortunately, domestic workers are essentially the last industry that is still excluded from basic occupational health and safety protections and rights in the country, and obviously in California. And domestic workers do the work that makes all other work possible. They take care of our most precious resources and in our lives. They take care of our homes. They take care of our elders. They take care of our children, people with disabilities, and they do not have any recourse if they are injured in the home as a workplace. And so the coalition has been advocating to really bring domestic workers under the jurisdiction of Cal OSHA so that we could actually work to prevent injuries and illnesses from happening. This issue really, really became a huge priority for our members in 2020, when we here in California had COVID was raging. And along with COVID, we had wildfires that were raging as well. And domestic workers were put in very difficult situations, many of them losing their lives. They lost so much work overnight. And those that were able to stay at work had to risk their lives every time they went to work. And so to do that without any health and safety guidance or protection from the government is just unacceptable. And so we've been advocating for a number of years now to really bring workers, give them that dignity, and that so that they would have the same rights that all other workers have.
Absolutely. And, I was blown away by attending this rally. I think there were at least 400, 500 people. 400 of y'all marched to the Capitol in Sacramento, demanding for this bill to be, addressed and signed. And some of the statistics that were shared at the press conference really struck me, right? Including that California has 700,000 domestic workers. Am I right?
Actually, California has approximately 350,000 domestic workers that work in the state. We have the largest density of domestic workers that are working in the entire country. It's a very large workforce that needs to be recognized for what it is. These are women that are working very hard, sustaining their own families, do very important work, and the work needs to be respected and valued and recognized and protected.
Right, absolutely. And, care work is what makes all the other work possible, right? It's actually the backbone for larger other work to happen effortlessly or seamlessly, yet it's the one that's most taken for granted, that's the least valued and invisibilized. And it's not a coincidence that it is largely women of color, poor women who do this work. So connecting the dots and making this issue more visible is thanks to groups like yours. And I also want to really lift up all the other groups that were there that day who are all part of your larger network. Can you also shine a light on who else is doing this work? I met so many groups who came from across California, from Southern California, and also the larger, and can you connect the dots to our listeners with the larger National Domestic Workers Alliance, just to get a sense of the incredible work that is happening on the ground to make this, to make these issues visible.
Yeah, it was a wonderful event at the mobilization that we had in Sacramento. Domestic workers came out from all over the state. We have a growing movement of domestic workers that are beginning to, or have been for a while, really organizing to learn more about their rights. They actively are involved in trainings, Know Your Rights trainings. Even as we go to Sacramento, they are the ones that are speaking to policymakers about how the lack of health and safety protections impacts them. And the work is deep, it's meaningful, and it's been reaching domestic workers across the state. So the coalition now, when we were first founded, I had about 7 organizations that we were working with, and that's grown to about 14 organizations in our movement across the state, where we do this deep work of outreaching to domestic workers that don't know about their rights, educating them, training them, making sure that they're able to advocate for themselves, because in the end, it's wonderful to pass policies, but in the end, it's the women themselves that are going to take a stand and make a difference and be able to enforce their own rights in the future. And that's one thing that they've shared with us, that they want to have the tools to be able to enforce their own rights, along, of course, with the responsibility that the government has as well. And along with domestic workers, we have been joined by employers that really also believe that this work is valuable work and it should be treated as such. So our movement has a growing participation of employers, along with like folks in organized labor. At the rally, we were so blessed to have like SEIU California with us and United Domestic Workers. AFSCME 3930 really support us and march with us as we're asking Governor Newsom and telling him that now's the time to actually make a difference and lead and sign SB 686 when it gets to his desk.
How can people who are educating themselves about this issue support the work y'all are doing at CDWC?
I would say you can go to our website, cadomesticworkers.org, and find out more information about like the work that we're doing, all of the educational materials that we have. We also have a lot of research that we've partnered with our research partners on for this industry. And join us. We're involved in a movement for dignity. And for, as you mentioned, the quality of care for those that provide it and also for those that receive it. There's a lot of talk about like how people value, how our culture should value and that we value care. But we need to put our what we say into action, by actually giving respect and putting resources into care, both protecting the workers that do this valuable work, but also providing resources for the people that most need it, like our elders and people mm-hmm. with disabilities that depend on, they spend so much of their lives in this culture working as hard as they can. And in the end, they also need to have the appropriate care and respect. And so join us as we're advocating for health and safety rights and jump on our website and join our listserv as we're building a stronger movement.
That's great. And, you know, I have to say your website is such a wonderful resource of all the history of all the organizing you'll have done. And currently, I, you know, as a feminist journalist tracking movements in the country, feminist movements in this country, I think the domestic workers movement is one movement that really gives a lot of hope and joy, because you'll have made so many strides in the last 10 or 15 years, right? Can you speak to the larger context of domestic worker organizing? Just paint a broad brushstroke on how domestic workers organizing has really built momentum over the years, in the last 10 or 15 years or so.
Yeah, I would say, like, I think that's what's been so inspirational. You know, there have been those that in the past have said that this industry could not be organized because it's disaggregate, meaning that you really, it's a workforce that works one-on-one inside of a private home. You don't have multiple workers. You can't find multiple workers under one roof. And there are a lot of power dynamics in the relationship between an employer and a worker. And despite all that, this movement is led by domestic workers, children of domestic workers, and allies. And it's had significant impact, not only at the local level, but many of our domestic workers have gone on to, you know, build a national movement through the National Domestic Workers Alliance that has, I believe it's like 65 affiliate organizations across the country. Many of those or some of those affiliates are in California. But they are all across the country passing bills of rights for domestic workers at the statewide level in multiple states. And as well, currently there's a national domestic worker bill of rights in Washington, D.C., along with the work that the National Domestic Workers Alliance and our affiliates have done to advance the issue of care and making sure that there are resources, you know, for care. And that's not to even leave out the work that the movement has done basically across internationally. We have a strong international movement that has been organizing for many, many years. And so there's a lot of beauty in the work and a lot more to be done. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that I think really strengthens in our movement is that it's wonderful to pass policies, but it's really about building a movement that is rooted in knowledge, that we organize in knowledge, making sure that our domestic workers have the tools that they need to enforce their own rights, and that together we will change the culture to bring some dignity overall to this arena.
You're broken down and tired of living life on the merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You've done it for this fund drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give $10, $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories. The site is kpfk.org, and there's a donate button. You are listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
Hi, I'm Marcy Winograd, co-producer of Code Pink Radio, Mondays, 4 p.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. I also report from Santa Barbara for KPFK's Rebel Alliance News. I've had a relationship with KPFK for decades. I can remember my mother frantically calling me up at 2 a.m. in the morning wanting to know what I was doing. I was still at KPFK editing a piece, a documentary on the coup in Chile when thousands of people were rounded up in the stadium during a very ugly chapter in history funded by the CIA. We are lucky. We are fortunate to have KPFK in Los Angeles, and I hope that you also appreciate what KPFK has to offer, basically the truth that you don't hear on corporate media. So please do support KPFK. Give us a call, make a pledge, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, or donate online at kpfk.org. Thanks so much for your support.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK, 90.7 FM, and kpfk.org.
So reproductive justice is an expansive and revolutionary vision.
In the shadow of debate over elective abortion, we sat down with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gomes to talk about a vision for the future that reaches deep into existing wisdom around care and caregiving. It starts with reading folks like June Jordan and Alice Walker.
She says, mothering is an instinct, yes, but it's also a skill. It can be taught. And she believes that everyone should learn the skills associated with mothering, because that's what we all need in order to actually shift into a life-giving, sustaining relationship to community, planet, life itself.
When the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, the loss of federal protection for elective abortion has forced individual states and even more intimate communities to grapple with their own beliefs and identities. But elective abortion is only one piece of a larger conversation about reproduction. The reproductive justice movement started in the mid-1990s by Black and Indigenous women argues, rarely do we find ourselves fighting for just one aspect of reproductive justice, such as abortion rights. We sat down with a daughter of the movement, Dr. Alexis Pauline Gomes, to talk about a vision for the path forward. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well. Yeah, I'm having a really good day so far.
Excellent.
What about you?
I was thinking, like, I know she's going to ask me that question, and like, what do I say, you know, considering everything. And also this week, my son had pneumonia.
Oh, no.
So we've been dealing with like 17-month-old baby fevers and ER trips in the last week. So it's been a little nuts.
No, that's not fun.
But he's better today. And that makes it good.
I'm glad to hear that.
Thanks. I'm so excited to talk to you today. Totally fangirling over here. And I'm going to go ahead and read this bio that I sort of like pieced together, because there's so much incredible, amazing stuff that you do, work that you do, that I wanted to highlight some things.
Sure.
But I mean, there's just no way to get to all of it. Like, it's so incredible. So I hope you like this bio that I put together. Alexis Pauline Gomes is a queer Black troublemaker and Black feminist love evangelist, founder or the co-founder of several community organizations focused on everything from ending gendered violence to land trust to healing work and all things media. She's a writer with work published in several outlets, 5 books already born and 1 in gestation called The Eternal Life of Audre Lorde. She's a winner of many awards, including a Whiting Award in nonfiction for her most recent book, Undrowned: Black Feminist Lessons from Marine Mammals. I'm not done. Alexis is a teacher, making access to regular folks a priority. She founded Brilliance Remastered, an online network and series of retreats and online intensives serving community accountable intellectuals and artists. I have to ask, does this mean our listeners?
Yes.
Okay, great. So it's very exciting. It seems that the uniting theme of all of her work is a passion for the issues that impact oppressed communities and an intimate knowledge of the resilience of movements led by Black, Indigenous, working class women, and queer people of color. What do you think?
That's right.
Does that sound about right? Yeah. Is there anything I missed? Anything you wanted to add?
No, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about things, but I like that bio. Thank you.
Okay, great. Today, we're going to be talking about the book, one of your books, one of your babies that you co-edited with China Martins and Maya Williams. This book is really very truly dear to me. Like, it's my friend. And the book is Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines. And if it's okay, I wanted to read some praise from Alice Walker.
Oh, I love that.
Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines is juicy, gutsy, vulnerable, and very brave. These women insist on having their children in a society that does not welcome them, in a world that is rapidly falling apart. Their dream for their children, based on their love of them, encompasses the sorrow and the joy that mothers everywhere, whether human, animal, or plant, feel at this time. A radical vision, many radical visions of how to mother in a time of resistance and of pain. There's a beautiful preface in the book by Professor Loretta Ross that it gives it is sort of a rich, almost like sensorial context to the formation of the reproductive justice movement. And in a minute, I am going to ask you to tell me the birth story of the book. Mm-hmm. But first, I was wondering if you could tell me and our listeners the birth story of the reproductive justice movement.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so the reason that we are so honored that Loretta Ross could have agreed to write a preface for Revolutionary Mothering is that we definitely know that that work wouldn't have been possible for us, imaginable even outside of the context of a reproductive justice movement. And Loretta Ross is one of the founding mothers of that movement. So reproductive justice is an expansive and revolutionary vision that is about really empowering all of us, but especially the people most impacted by multiple systems of oppression, to have autonomy over what happens with our capacity to create, what happens in terms of our ability to define and create the relationships that we have, the families that we want, the destinies that we want for our own bodies. And its expansiveness is in some way the response of feminists of color, including Loretta Ross, to what they saw as some of the limitations to the idea of reproductive rights, in quotes. And so they wanted to create something that really spoke to the multiple ways that our capacity as beings that are part of a species that can proliferate, that needs each other to survive, that lives and relates in units of community beyond the question of access to abortion or not access to abortion. And also that takes into account the histories of coerced sterilization. It takes into account histories of experimentation with birth control drugs on impoverished women in Puerto Rico. All of these different truth-telling imperatives are part of what makes the reproductive justice movement exist.
I love an intellectual.
I have to tell you that. I mean, you know, I'm a nurse, and I don't know if you know other nurses, but, you know, we are very, like, of the earth. And so, like, it is so stimulating to talk to somebody who's kind of the clouds, you know what I mean? Like, in a most, sure. in a lovely way. Because I'm thinking, tell me the birth story. And I'm thinking, it was 1994, and these women gathered in Chicago, and they ate at Chipotle, or, you know, and then, you know, and then, right, they went back to the South. And they formed Sister Song, right?
Yes. Also, there's a really important essay in an anthology called The Color of Violence that Incite Women of Color Against Violence published, where Loretta Ross writes her definition of reproductive justice, which I would refer everyone to, because that is the, for me, that's the best way to hear that origin story, aside from if you're very blessed and get to just listen to Loretta Ross or Billy Avery themselves. So there's Sister Song was really the space to say, like, to sing what reproductive justice is and to roll that out into the world. And Loretta Ross was the founding executive director of Sister Song. And the Sister Song conferences, the Let's Talk About Sex conferences, became this catalyzing movement space. One of the things that they did that I love is that they had mother-daughter fellowships to go to the conference. And so my mother and I went to Sister Song in Chicago.
That is so beautiful.
Together. I think that at the core of reproductive justice is, and I've heard Loretta Ross recently talk about this as like a reproductive futurity, is that it is intergenerational. It lives in intergenerationality. And they have moved that way the entire time. So in Atlanta, there's a place called Mother House. And this was it's really a house. It was the headquarters for Black Women's Health Project. And just to give a corner to the story, which really probably only I can tell you, when I was a teenage writer growing up in Atlanta, I went to Mother House to the basement to lead a writing workshop and facilitate the creation of a newsletter, like a newsletter about sex for the teenagers. And I was a teenager. They were like children who were part of the summer program that Black Women's Health Project had as part of its initiative for there to be intergenerational conversations about sex and profoundly comprehensive sex education. And so that was actually the first time that as a writer facilitator, I ever was paid to facilitate a writing workshop, which to me keys into this idea of reproductive justice movement generating our creativity in all these multiple ways, right? And then the children, who many of them were children of the same reproductive justice movement workers, just were having these incredible conversations about sexuality and gender and fluidity and justice and autonomy and consent, like all of these things. And so it was a blessing to be able to have an intergenerational view on that from a young age.
It's so cool that you had such a front row seat.
Yeah.
And like how neat that it really ties into the book, I feel like, because a lot of the book that you co-edited is talking about the actual work of mothering as revolutionary work itself. And so this idea that your mother was taking you to these places, she was raising a revolutionary. I mean, look at you now, you know, like she did the work, you know, and now look at you like putting it out into the world in even bigger, further ways. What's the birth story of this book?
Oh, yay. Okay. So it goes back to a internet love story. My would-be future co-editor, Maya, and I met on the internet. And I think we both have been making zines for a long time. We blog, and I think we found each other that way. And Maya was wanting to use a workbook I had made with these women in South Africa who had taken over an abandoned factory to create their own school with their children. And I was like, what? Who is this person? You know, I was like,
this is what you do. But so Maya is an international human rights worker and journalist. And she, while we were cultivating our friendship, she was traveling all over the world and she was organizing with mothers. She was organizing with moms who were part of the Zapatista movement. She was organizing with moms who were part of the Arab Spring uprising. She was organizing in Palestine. And in all of these spaces, she was telling me what was going on and the revolution.
She was finding the moms.
She was finding the moms. Yeah. And she already had a really clear understanding that that is revolutionary. And then she started to create this zine called Revolutionary Motherhood. Meanwhile, I am in the archive researching. I'm working on my PhD and my dissertation is called We Can Learn to Mother Ourselves, The Queer Survival of Black Feminism. And so I'm looking at everything that these feminists of color are saying about mothering in the 1980s, 1970s and 1980s. And so I'm looking through Audre Lorde's papers. I'm looking through June Jordan's papers. I'm looking through finding these Azalea and the Salsa Soul Sister Gazette and, you know, all of these out-of-print publications that are basically ancestors to our zines that we're creating. And I'm telling her what I find, right? And so she's like, listen to what happened in Gaza. And I'm like, listen to what June Jordan said in 1977, you know?
You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy. And that was the kind of story we love to highlight. Not just stories of what's going wrong. We like to bring you stories of activists telling you how they're standing up to injustice, and feminist artists and creatives who are making films and writing books about ways to make change in the world, different ways to see the world. Plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action and make a difference yourself. So that's what we actually mean when we say at the top of the show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist, but also engage. And you can support us to keep doing that right now. You just go to kpfk.org, the website, and you click the donate button. And this is Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. And I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And we're proud to be on KPFK, along with a whole other host of varied voices from the community, but also varied perspectives, perspectives that you're not going to hear anywhere else on the radio dial, not in any of the kind of canned and already digested versions of news that you'll get anywhere else. But right here on KPFK, we're bringing you stories from our activism, from our lives, and from folks that we're excited to share with you. You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy.
If you're listening to us right now, KPFK may be one of your favorite things. You should know that KPFK is one of the stations in the Pacifica Radio Network. The concept of community radio in the United States was established when the Pacifica Foundation started KPFA in Berkeley in 1949. A decade later, KPFK came on the airwaves and ever since has strived to fulfill the Pacifica mission. To contribute to a lasting understanding between nations and individuals of all races, creeds, and colors. To promote creative activities that serve the cultural welfare of our community and stimulate grassroots radio content. And to be self-sustaining. And this is where you're able to play a crucial role. We're listener-sponsored radio. So you fund our operations and in doing so, realize Pacifica's noble mission. Right now, you can call 818-985-5735 and pledge support to one of your favorite things. KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK, 90.7 FM, and kpfk.org.
At some point, we were like, okay, this conversation that we're having is actually a real conversation. Like, we are meant to put together this archive and legacy of a revolutionary approach to mothering and contemporary people who are living this and practicing it right now. So we should create an anthology. This is our idea. And then we met China Martins, who's our would-be co-editor at the Allied Media Conference. And China's like almost a generation older than Maya and I. Maya and I are pretty close in age. And China is like zine's forerunner. Like she was the first person to write mothering zines about being a mother, about raising a kid on welfare. She was really the first. And the Future Generation is the name of her zine. And so we were like, yes, you know, like this is our trifecta dream team. At the beginning, we thought we were going to call it This Bridge Called My Baby. And when we sent out our call for submissions, that's what we said. And we're creating an anthology called This Bridge Called My Baby. And, you know, so many people sent in essays and poems and stories. And we were like, whoa, this is amazing. And we started this process of the intensive work of creating an anthology. And it took like 7 years before it actually existed in print. Anyway, so the reason that we created this book was because we really felt that there was something to be said about, again, intergenerationally, what it means to really just shine light on a revolutionary approach to mothering, right? Because we're very clear, like, we're not creating that. It's something very, very old.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to us that, we were like over the moon, ready to pass out when Alice Walker wrote that blurb, because her idea of democratic motherism, it talks about mothering as a form of being in the world and really as the ethical form of being in the world, and that it can include everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a line in that essay where she says, mothering is an instinct, yes, but it's also a skill that can be taught. And she believes that everyone should learn the skills associated with mothering, because that's what we all need in order to actually shift into a life-giving, sustaining relationship to community, planet, life itself. And so the deepest thing that we wanted recognition for all of this revolutionary labor that we're naming as revolutionary mothering that has been happening for generations, and without which certainly the three of us wouldn't exist as who we are, or maybe at all. And it's possible to think that maybe life wouldn't exist, right? There are these constant acts of life-giving and care that are transformative and revolutionary because they exist right up against these forms of oppression that have seemingly done everything to eradicate them.
Wow, that's quite a birth story.
Yes, thank you for asking.
Well, I have to tell you, like, the reason why I reached out to you recently about doing this interview and talking about this book that was published in 2016, you know, it's not like there's like a timely stamp on this or whatever, right. Except that there is.
Right.
Because I have to tell you, I was raised in central Indiana by lesbian pastors. So,
yeah.
Protestant, right? So while I don't practice religion anymore, I have this tendency that I think is residual from my raising that is during times of stress or confusion, like to go to text. Mm-hmm. You know, Protestants love their Bible study. I got to tell you that. I don't know if you knew that, but Protestants,
I didn't know that.
Protestants love their Bible study. So I don't really turn to the Bible, but I go to my bookshelf, and I feel like all of our different states and communities are pretty much trying to decide who they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I have not heard the word abortion so much ever in my life before being discussed openly.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, are there other things that you think people could be reading right now as they're kind of grappling with whatever is happening in their communities?
Oh, what a great question. I mean, of course, people we've mentioned, right? Alice Walker is somebody who to always read, but I would say especially her essays. When we think about abortion, she's somebody who's been very open about the fact that this is a part of her experience and her early politicization as a young woman, a young college student, and she has this expansive perspective that I draw on over and over again. So read more Alice Walker. June Jordan, definitely. So, and I'll just say the essay that we were so honored to print in Revolutionary Mothering is called The Creative Spirit in Children's Literature. And this is the place where June Jordan makes the proclamation that love is life force. And this is a talk that she gave at a conference about children's literature at Berkeley in California in 1977. And the first sentence is just, love is life force. That's it. The end. Like, that's everything right there. And she goes on to offer this incredible, expansive definition of what creativity is, what creation is, and how it exists within all species. And then she talks about the accountability of what our intergenerational conversation is, right? So what's at stake in children's literature for June Jordan is what is the possible conversation we can have between generations? And she just goes deep into like, what is it? What are the fears that brings up in adults? What's disrespectful about not talking about certain things with young people?
And before we get away from it, I do want to, if it's okay, I want to read like just a very short piece from this essay that you're making reference to, if it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
June Jordan says, "And it seems to me that love, that is serious and tender concern to respect the nature and the spontaneous purpose of other things, other people, will make manifest a peaceable order among us, such that fear, conflict, competition, waste, and environmental sacrifice will have no place." That passage means a lot. It's like, that's everything. Like, what else is there
that's
to say?
That's everything, like right? Said. It's everything yeah. that we need. Like, we would do this one thing.
Yeah.
We would do this one thing.
We could just, like, live like this. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that I can never get too much of June Jordan. So I turn to so many. I turn to Angela Davis. I turn to my dear sister, Adrienne Marie Brown. I turn to Walida E. Marisha. I turn, of course, to Loretta Ross. So I'm a creative writing editor at the journal Feminist Studies. And there's a resource on the Feminist Studies website that, in response to the Supreme Court decision, that we decided to create, and it kind of chronicles, because because this is an issue that is in the journal all the time. But it chronicles an archive going back, it's 50 years that this journal has existed. You could look at that to give kind of a long view of how feminist thinkers have been writing about this over time. There's so much reading to do.
We're jumping in to remind you that you are listening to Making Contact and an interview with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gums. Visit us online at radioproject.org, where you can join the conversation with a comment. And now back to the show. And we've talked about reading. We've talked about holding workshops. Is there anything else that you're doing to find hope right now, or kind of manage yourself and your community?
Yeah, I think the other things on a smaller scale has just been more reaching out. You know, like I have kind of had to get over it. And even me being like, oh, nobody wants to really hear from me, or, oh, I can't, you know, like, let me stay within the boundary of not reaching out even to people I do know, or like my own friends, you know, like that's been a thing that I've struggled with. And now I see, I'm like, oh, that's complicit in the forms of isolation that those who would harm all of us want to exist so that we don't acknowledge our collective power, right? And act accordingly. And so that's definitely been a way. I am not a nurse, but I'm like a major distributor of just raspberry leaf to people, you know, like, it's just, I'm like, this will help. You know, I have my little peppermint raspberry leaf.
Your tinctures and your
witchy tea,
brews.
You know, all of that. And and also just that practice for myself, you know, I mean, it's tied to what Loretta Ross is talking about, this legacy of us taking care of ourselves and each other and learning what that takes in relationship with the natural world.
Taking care of yourself is revolution. Taking care of your children is revolution. As a mom of human babies, it doesn't always feel that way. It is work that is unseen and unappreciated by capitalism completely. And so it, you know, to all you moms out there, keep your head up like you're doing it.
Yes.
And to all the people who are doing mothering work that isn't to human babies, it's important work too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that our dream for revolutionary mothering includes. It's to say that the exact isolation that you're talking about, where capitalism pretends to not value the labor of mothering, but it needs it.
It needs it. It
at
requires
the same time.
It, doesn't it?
Right.
Doesn't it?
That is what we want to shine a light on. All of those acts of care, the disgusting, you know, if someone's spitting up on you, you know, all those things are happening. Those have such revolutionary potential. And what would a world be like where we valued that in such a way that the actual labor of it wasn't isolated either, right? And that is, in fact, dangerous to capitalism. It's certainly dangerous to any system that would want to disempower anyone, but particularly disempower women, because, there's too much love. There's too much love and creativity. And when we collaborate on it,
that's some powerful stuff.
That's it. Love is life force.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
So thank you so much for having me. It's great to meet you. And I also just want to honor what you're doing, how you're using this platform, how you're using your own perspective and expertise to create this really supportive and transformative space. I'm grateful for you.
Thank you for saying that. I'm grateful for you. You have a wonderful day.
You too.
I'm Amy Gastelum. We sat down with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gums to talk about a vision for the future that reaches deep into existing wisdom around care and caregiving.
You can support KPFK and our show today. You go to the kpfk.org website. It's really easy. You just click the donate button, walk through a couple of steps, and there you are. You can choose to make a donation of $25, $50, or you might want to be a subscribing supporter, and that would be great. We would love you to do that. Big part of what we do here on Feminist Magazine is that we're a collective of diverse voices and contributors, and that means we bring a bunch of different viewpoints to our listeners, all kinds of perspectives and stories and guests every week. And we're teaching radio skills like interviewing, engineering, and editing to young college students and to grassroots feminists from different communities across the city. But most of all, we give our time and sweat to Feminist Magazine because we believe in radio as a tool for activism and solidarity building. I'm an activist in other parts of the community. All of the contributors here are involved in many different ways. And all through the lockdown and the pandemic, we just kept it going remotely for you. A lot of the folks here at KPFK who bring you shows are actively involved in the communities that they're bringing you stories about, so that you know what we're bringing you is authentic, it's real, and we're always looking for different angles to stories to bring you things that you haven't heard about in the mainstream media. KPFK, as you know, is people-powered radio. It's funded by people like you. And in these times, this is when we need you to step up and give back to the station that you're listening to and support KPFK. So show us a little love, won't you? You go to the kpfk.org website. It's really easy. You just click the donate button, walk through a couple of steps, and there you are. And we are going to be wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Thank you to all of our guests and our contributors to today. And here is your chance to support KPFK in this hour. This is your last chance to support KPFK in this feminist hour on KPFK. If you liked what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, if you liked the kind of stories we covered, please support us to keep doing that. You will be showing not just your appreciation, but you'll be putting your money where your mouth is. You'll be actually supporting more of these kind of stories. You'll be enabling us to keep these kind of voices on the air and showing us that you support these kind of stories, that you support grassroots stories, that you support stories about folks making a difference, stepping up, taking radical action. Those are the kind of stories that we bring you on Feminist Magazine every week. What we bring you is stories that are not just about quote-unquote women's issues, but radical feminist, intersectional feminist, feminism that looks at environmental issues, at climate change from a feminist point of view. This is your last chance, like I said, to support us in this hour. You go to the kpfk.org website. It's really easy. You just click the donate button, walk through a couple of steps, and there you are. And thank you.
Hi, KPFK listeners. This is Abby Martin.
And this is Mike Preisner. We're the creators of the political documentary series, The Empire Files.
We're also longtime listeners and supporters of KPFK. That's why we're so proud to be supporting KPFK and its fund drive, because we know the crucial work and reporting of this organization is an essential weapon in this fight.
Call 818-985-5735 and tell KPFK they are not alone in the fight for the preservation of freedom, civil and human rights with justice.
That's 818-985-5735. And I would be very honored if our message today was the push you needed to give KPFK the help it requires to carry on.
Support comes from Art Don't Sleep and Jazz is Dead, presenting French-Lebanese trumpeter and composer Ibrahim Malouf at The Lodge, Saturday, May 4th in Highland Park. Maluf's compositions have caught the eye